Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be covering the feature film, which was written by Star Trek Nemesis writer John Logan, Any Given Sunday. But before we do that, we just wanted to briefly touch on this new television show called Orville, which I know we've talked about before.
Yes.
But it's Seth MacFarlane's creation. Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy and
Cleveland Show
fame. Ted. He did the Ted movies.
Oh, that's right. Ted and Ted 2. Yeah.
And he also appeared on a couple episodes of Enterprise.
The one and probably only time that he hosted the Oscars, he had William Shatner in his opening bit.
Yes, he did. He did. And he's a very big Star Trek fan, and he is doing his own take on Star Trek in a sense. He's doing a show called Orville, which is about a spaceship which is part of some sort of federation 300 years in the future, or the 23rd century, I think, you know, whatever, you know, same time period as Star Trek. And it's about, you know, a ship which is exploring or doing whatever it's doing. But the twist is that instead of being the flagship with the finest, you know, officers in the fleet on the finest ship in the fleet, it's the crew and the ship, which is maybe not the best in the fleet, you know?
Yeah, maybe the ship that is in the quadrant, but they're not going to call them.
Right.
So that when they do call the best ship in the quadrant, they can say, you're the only people we got.
Exactly. And, you know, from what people have been saying, it is a comedy, but it doesn't sound like it's, you know, Family Guy comedy. It sounds, you know, like it's maybe Guardians of the Galaxy style comedy, you know?
Yeah.
Where there's definitely some dramatic, like, underpinnings to this show, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people are saying that it is kind of a return to what Star Trek was. And Seth MacFarlane, being a huge Star Trek fan and wanting to make his version of Star Trek, has decided to surround himself with a ton of Star Trek veterans. You know, for example, his fellow writers and producers include David A. Goodman, who wrote for Enterprise, and that's how MacFarlane got on the show. There was a whole thing where, like, he talks about this in the 50-year mission thing, where, like, Goodman was, you know, was talking to Rick Berman because Rick Berman had just discovered Family Guy and he thought it was amazing. So he would call Goodman into his office to just talk about Family Guy. And Goodman's like, hey, Seth MacFarlane is a big fan, blah, blah, blah. You should bring him on the show. So they brought him on the show. And when MacFarlane was on Enterprise, that's when he met Branham Braga, who is going to be a writer-producer on this show as well.
Yeah.
And the two of them have worked together a few times, most notably on Cosmos, the update with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Right. Right.
So three Star Trek, well, if you count Seth MacFarlane, three Star Trek people in the writer's room, you know, MacFarlane, Goodman, who also, by the way, wrote the Where No Fan Has Gone Before episode of Futurama.
Oh, gosh, that is, which is one of its finest half hours.
Yeah. Yes. And he also wrote the biography of Captain Kirk and the upcoming biography of Captain Picard, and like the history of the Federation Part One or whatever it is, those books.
Yeah.
He wrote those too. Super fan, obviously. And also, you know, like, ran Family Guy for like 25 years or whatever. So you know, the solid writing staff, but that it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. Because one of the members of the cast in addition to Seth MacFarlane, is Penny Johnson-Gerald, who played Cassidy Yates on Deep Space Nine.
There you go.
So that's pretty cool. But then, but then it doesn't stop there at all, because
you look at
the directors and MacFarlane, because they're shooting now. They got a full season order, which is good because it's on Fox. So, you know, we know that it's going to be canceled, but at the end of the season.
We know that it'll be canceled, but when the DVD comes out, there's going to be like 5-6 unaired episodes that we're going to get.
Yes, exactly. And then maybe like 3 or 4 years later, we'll get a feature film. You never know.
No, what they have to do is they have to sell it off so that Comedy Central or Cartoon Network can air it late at night for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then they bring it back in some sort of revival format.
Yes, yes. All of these things are going to happen. But first, we're going to get 13 episodes, which is nice. And the first episode, the pilot, is directed by Jon Favreau, which, you know, not a Star Trek person, but hey, you know, bringing out the big guns.
Right.
I mean, he did Iron Man, right? And then the second episode is directed by James L. Conway, who directed the pilot for Enterprise, as well as a bunch of other things like Way of the Warrior and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, super Star Trek director. Episode 3, Robert Duncan McNeil, you know?
That's a familiar name to Star Trek fans as well.
Yeah, Tom Paris, but also, you know, very good director in his own right, having directed Enterprise. All these people worked on Enterprise in some capacity or another, which is kind of weird, but whatever. Episode 4 is directed by Brandon Braga himself, who, you know, he's directed a few episodes of Salem. And I think the very first thing he ever directed was the pilot for Cosmos. And that pilot, the direction, the visual style in that pilot is absolutely amazing. Like, mind-blowingly good. I mean, you watch that and you're like, this is some next-level stuff. And to think that it was directed by a first-time director,
but
insane.
Somebody who had paid a lot of attention through the years and,
knew
what
sure.
he was, what he had in his head, and, you know, had paid attention to how to express it. Sure.
It was just interesting because it wasn't like even a piece of like narrative filmmaking. It was like, you know, kind of like much more abstract and sort of like informational and everything. And it's, I don't know, but he knocked it out of the park. And we've never seen Brandon Braga direct Star Trek, oddly enough. And now we're kind of going to get to see it. You know?
Yeah, well, and I mean, the thing is, it's also cool that they're going to do a comic take on it, because you know that people with experiences from the set, or even just the way that they would maybe joke between takes about what would happen and stuff like that, they're going to bring that with them. And who better to tell a Star Trek joke than somebody who's worked on Star Trek?
Yeah, and will it necessarily be like a Star Trek joke? I don't know. I mean, like, you look at the original series, there's a lot of really funny episodes in there. You know, that's something which was kind of lost in the Next Gen era. I mean, certainly, I mean, like, especially on Deep Space Nine, there were a lot of comedic episodes, but, you know.
Well, but what I'm saying is, like, they'll be able to imbue it with that sense of you have to know the rules to break the rules for the joke
to work.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. Yeah.
So if you bring in somebody who doesn't know how it works, the joke is harder to tell.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, McNeil or Braga can come on and can be like, oh, no. I know how to twist this one around.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's cool. Now, episode 5 is directed by another familiar name, Jonathan Frakes.
How crazy is that?
Yeah, and you know, he does this thing on Twitter
so crazy,
where he posts like pictures of like random buildings or like a bush or a tree or a mountain, and he's like, where am I now? Like, that's just a question, you know, and people try to figure out where he is now. Well, he posted a picture the other day of him on a set sitting outside of a window that looks like it's in 10 Forward, and he goes, you know, where am I now? Right. And he's on the set of Orville, but you look at that set, just that, I mean, all you see is a window with stars outside, and it looks like it's something which was lifted right out of Next Generation and, you know, stuck in this other show.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So, it's going to be a fun show to watch, I think.
I agree.
Or however long Fox allows it to air.
I agree. I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's like we're basically getting two Star Trek shows this year.
At least one. Let's phrase it that way. We're getting at least one in the year 2017.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. No. Les Moonves, was that a thing just recently? He said,
I know.
Early fall, which lines right up with your theory, you know, September 8th, you know, at this point, if they're going to be that close.
Do you know how insufferable I'm going to be if I'm correct?
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's going to be like Mike is going, everybody listening to the sound of my voice, Mike's going to mute me on every channel I know how to reach him for like a week after that.
But but it's okay. I'm rooting for it. I'm hoping that it happens.
Yeah. I lay money down on it.
I want to see you proven right. So, yeah.
I'd love to be proven wrong and have them release it earlier. But
I'd be okay with that too. But you know, yeah. But if they do it on like September 9th or something like that, I'm going to be very upset. You know. So whatever. Yeah. All right. Well, should we get into today's feature?
Let's do it.
All right. So, you know, I remember this from back in the day, you know, they were working on the fourth Next Generation movie and, you know, Rick Berman would always do his interviews for the Star Trek Communicator where he'd give updates on the franchise, probably with Larry Nemechek, you know, guessing. Yeah. And at one point, they asked him, like, what's the status of the new movie, and he's like, oh, the new movie, it's coming along great. We have an A-list writer who has not worked on Star Trek before, but he is A-list. He's done some top quality, you know, movies, and he's a fan, and he's involved writing the script, and it's amazing. And I got really excited about that, and, you know, of course, I was like, you know, who is it? Could it be this guy? Could it be this guy? And then when they finally announced that it was John Logan, I was like, oh, yeah, that's awesome. Because, I mean, at that point, he had been nominated for one of his three Academy Award nominations, you know, and that was for Gladiator. I think he had also been nominated for an Emmy for his TV movie, RKO 281.
Yeah, the one about the making of Citizen Kane.
Yeah, so that was cool and everything. But the movie that he had written, which was a huge standout to me, which I always, you know, thought was absolutely 100% his masterpiece, was Any Given Sunday, which was directed by Oliver Stone, co-written by Oliver Stone, starring Al Pacino and a bunch of other people, Jamie Foxx, Dennis Quaid, Cameron Diaz,
yeah,
Jim Brown, who we talked about the real-life version.
Yeah, seriously, Jim Brown's in it. And they've got
Lawrence Taylor.
CNLT. I did not see this when it was out in the theaters because I've nursed a very long-standing grudge with Mr. Stone that everybody should be familiar with going into it. He directed The Doors.
Yeah, that movie shame wasn't good. That movie wasn't
shame.
Good.
Well, but, as a Doors fan,
but,
shame on you.
But he also made a lot of really, really good movies like Natural Born Killers and JFK. And
JFK is another. JFK is one of those ones. It's a brilliantly made film, an absolute, just fantastic viewing experience. But if you know anything about history, it gets under your skin eventually.
I've always seen his. I always see his movies, his historical movies, in a similar fashion. That I see Any Given Sunday in relation to football, which is like, this is not like factually, you know, necessarily accurate, but what it does is it creates the feeling of history.
It's one thing to approach football, you know, like have something that's a metaphorical story of football and then have something and say, this is actual history. And I know you get into that whole muddy water about the biopic thing. And honestly, the JFK thing I can live with. It's just as a lifelong Doors / Jim Morrison fan,
That's where
I got swept up in that movie when I was a wee lad. And then as I returned to it through the years and I had done more of my own research, it was one of those things where I was watching and I was like, this isn't right at all. And it was, and it's just one of those things where just over time, I mean, never mind the fact that he got, I mean, Stone always gets incredible performances out of people, right? And, you know, so you got Kilmer in the Doors, got everybody in the Doors, you got JFK, but this, I never saw it in the theater and I could kick myself for it. This is a masterpiece. This is 5 stars on fire. I was mesmerized the entire, I could not, like there was one point where I had to pause it and get up and go to the bathroom. And I was doing that whole like running to the bathroom thing and running back. Cause I was just, I didn't want to miss the flow of this thing. It's amazing.
Okay. So would you like to give like a synopsis of this movie?
Wow. I think the best synopsis is it's the movie that the NFL doesn't want you to see because it's really about kind of how things operate.
What? Wait, why wouldn't the NFL want you to see this movie?
I don't know. Maybe about all of the stuff that the doctor overlooks and putting damaged people out on the field and reassuring and the things that they do to damage themselves and this pursuit of glory and the overemphasis on what is a sport. Like it's almost like the evil twin of For Love of the Game.
Yeah.
Like For Love of the Game presents this very pure, noble vision of a sport. And then this is like, no, this is the bad brother you don't talk about.
It's interesting because I put the two of those movies together a lots of times because they came out 3 months apart. One of them I consider to be sort of like the definitive depiction of like baseball, like coming up with this sort of like visceral portrayal of a sport, you know, like not just sort of like the distanced watching it on television, but like, you know, shooting it in a way that you feel like you're playing that sport. Like,
right.
That's what I see For Love of the Game at. That's why I respond so well to For Love of the Game. And that's definitely how I see Any Given Sunday.
Yeah.
And yet, like you're saying, their take on the sport that they're portraying is quite different.
I actually thought I would have one of the things that really bothers me a lot of times when I go to, was it Sum of All Fears? Was that the Ben Affleck movie about the Tom Clancy Ben Affleck movie?
Yes.
When I watch a movie and they have, you know, like the Baltimore Bombers versus the Texas pickup trucks or something, you know, and it's like it takes me out of it because I'm like, this is not like you're trying to convince me this is reality. And you're basically flipping me the bird and saying this is reality. I know it's not reality. You just made me check out of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was going to be a big hurdle for me. But one of the real strengths with the way this thing is constructed is they even make reference to real life football teams very fleetingly, but it lets it therefore occupy this thing that's sort of like you could look at it as sort of like an XFL or a USFL sort of thing. You can't view it as arena football because they actually run. But the, you know, like it's that thing where he very interestingly nests it in such a way that you can believe that this is also happening in your world.
Yeah. I mean, probably what it would actually be, you know, thinking about it, the way that they talk about it, you know, it's almost like on the same competitive level. So it almost seems like it would be kind of like NFL versus AFL from back in the day.
Sure.
But it's like when you're watching the movie, the way that it is this sort of like hyper real version of football, it really does feel in a lot of ways like you're watching the XFL,
know,
which is like if the XFL was as big as they thought it would be.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, if anyone's interested, and I don't know if you've seen this, but there is a documentary out there on ESPN now called This is the XFL about the history of the XFL, which was directed by the son of the co-creator of the XFL.
Oh, man.
It's only like an hour long or whatever. Highly, highly, highly recommended. It's amazing.
I will have to see that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean,
it's not, you can get it on the ESPN app and all that stuff. So,
But I mean, this film is such, from its basic construction forward. Like, it's just solidly manufactured. It's solidly put together. Like, there isn't. And the thing is, I saw the director's cut. I'm pretty sure that's the one that's streaming, because I looked up the running times and it was the correct running time for the director's cut.
Like 2 hours and 37 minutes or whatever?
Right.
Okay. Did you see the eyeball?
Yes.
Okay. I think it's the director's cut then.
Okay. I'm pretty sure it's the director's cut, because I know there are two running times. One was the theatrical, which was, and you walked me through this. The theatrical is 6 minutes longer, but 12 minutes was excised, and then six different minutes were put in and recut.
Yeah.
For the director's cut. So there's an aggregate 18 minutes difference,
mm-hmm.
but it's 6 minutes shorter.
Yeah.
And it's that weird. Almost makes it a Star Trek movie in and of itself, because it seems to bend space time.
I need to watch, because I haven't seen the theatrical since the theater. But I did see this when it came out in the theater, and I was blown away by it then. And every time I watch it now, I think I love it more. I think it might be Oliver Stone's best movie.
And I would stand behind that, sure.
I mean, I know a lot of people will probably say that that's crazy, but I really do. The energy, the non-stop everything in this yeah. movie is so impressive. Like, I have no idea how they edited this movie. And I know that Oliver Stone is yeah. crazy good at editing. You know, I mean, JFK is considered to be like one of the pinnacles of editing by filmmakers, you know, and, you know, Natural Born Killers, same thing. But this, I mean, I have no idea how they would have sorted through this much stuff and kept up this pace for yeah. so long. Because like you're saying, it does not let up. And yeah. it is such a visceral experience. The use of music, the performances, the photography, yeah. everything works so well. But even when you strip away all of that viscera or whatever, you know, what you're left with is this script, which is really freaking solid, you know?
Yes, it is. It is. It's incredibly well written. And I know that somewhere along the way, and they have credits as technical advisors, they brought in, I don't know whether it was complete or pieces of other scripts that were sort of approaching the same subject and hammered them together and took pieces of those. And so in the credits, those people are listed as technical consultants.
Interesting.
It's a very interesting breakdown of the credits. But, I mean, that doesn't take away from the fact that you're right. I would like to believe, based on seeing it, that this is the type of script where anybody could have come in and made a good film out of it. But yeah. Oliver Stone making it made it insane.
Right. And it made it a masterpiece.
Well, it's like, I mean, the greatest Oliver Stone movies, in all honesty, are where he doesn't feel like, okay, Platoon is a fantastic film as I remember it, but it follows certain rules that I don't think come naturally to Stone. This is like spending 2.5 hours in his head. Like, I yeah. can imagine this is what it feels like if I were to like being John Malkovich. I'm suddenly inside Oliver Stone's head
mm-hmm.
and come out the other end, and like, I'm good for a little bit, but that was a hell of a 2.5 hours.
Right. I know that's kind of how I feel about like Born on the 4th of July. Like, I watched that movie and I'm like, this is a good movie. I can appreciate it, but boy, is it sappy and kind of standard, you yeah. know, which I know, like, you look at Born on the 4th of July and you're like, that's sappy and standard. Like, what are you talking about? But it's like you compare it to Natural Born Killers and it is incredibly standard. You know, I mean, this yeah. is definitely how I like my Oliver Stone, you know, like crazy and pushed to the max. And it's so well done. I mean, all of the performances are fantastic. Al Pacino is
see this is the thing, is Pacino basically has two phases to his career. He has subtle Godfather Al Pacino, and then he has hoo-ah post Son of a Woman Al Pacino, and yeah. that Pacino can be very grating. But you get him in the right environment. You get him in Heat. You get him in this. It really works well. It's just the right Pacino for it.
Mm-hmm. I remember, yeah, at the time, we have a local film critic, Nick DiGilio, who's on WGN Radio, and he was talking about Pacino's performance and how, you know, he would just start yelling at random times, you know? You never knew where or when, didn't really make any sense. But it works so well. You know, not to mention, I mean, God, everyone who they surround him with. I mean, a very young Jamie Foxx in one of his early, you know, dramatic roles and everything. And, you know, using like a lot of people basically as themselves. I mean, Lawrence Taylor is not an actor, right? But he's perfect in this movie, you know? Playing himself.
And the thing is, having LT in it and then also having like Dick Butkus play a coach and having Barry Switzer there and having all these recognizable names. It adds a whole layer for me when I was watching it that this felt like these guys giving the NFL the finger in the only way they could without the NFL destroying their families.
Yeah.
Like this was their way to be like, hey, NFL, right here. So
yeah. And by also, I mean, Cameron Diaz. Oh my God.
Yeah,
so good in this movie, you know? Yeah. I mean, a very different role than what she usually plays. I've always thought that she was a really, really good actress, but I think this is my favorite performance of hers.
I have a question for you, because she has what I think is a standout scene with Charlton Heston at one point.
And Charlton Heston's in it.
Well, right. But this occupies a very odd space, because you see Charlton Heston in Ben-Hur in the film. And then you see Charlton Heston as the commissioner, but at no point do they say anything but Mr. Commissioner. It kind of works to be like, well, yeah, okay, Chuck Heston is the commissioner of this league. Sure. Why not?
I never thought of that, but if they never say his name, then
I don't think they do.
Okay, then I'm going to say yes. Let's say that it is Charlton Heston who is the commissioner of football, because that seems like a Charlton Heston thing to do.
Yeah. And it actually makes that scene from Ben-Hur where you see him work even better.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Like, you know, some people they start their career, like Jim Brown starts his career in the NFL and then moves into movies. Charlton Heston started in the movies and then moved to the NFL. So
there you go. And I do want to give a special note to Jim Brown, because I thought he actually brought a really good balance to Pacino. You could see a chemistry. You could believe this chemistry that Pacino was the head coach and Jim Brown was the guy that he could rely on, that was going to keep, you know, when the seas got rough, was going to help quietly keep everything under control.
Yeah, Brown is definitely his right-hand man who, you know, keeps him in check, you know, and there's like that scene where they're in the bar and they're reminiscing. And, I mean, stuff like that is great because, you know, you see Brown, like, talking about basically how the game has sort of, like, passed him by in a sense.
Yeah.
And gotten to a thing that is not anywhere near what it was when he was playing. And how he, you know, like he wants to give it all up and become like a high school coach because, you know, it's pure and everything. And you can see, I mean, that he's speaking from the heart there, you know? I mean, this is, you know, very much he's bringing his life experience into this, and it's pretty great. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's so good. I mean, everything, I mean, we haven't even touched on things like, you know, James Woods, you know.
James Woods is always, I mean, you give him the right James Woods role and he's just going to nail it 100% of the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he's...
And Matthew Modine is great, and his whole character, I mean, there are so many character arcs in this film that are all going on at the same time, and at no point... we've all seen plenty of films where they have tons of characters, and at some point you're like, wait, what was their arc again? Wait, okay, well, how do they relate to stuff? And everything's clear in this.
Yeah.
Like, it just makes perfect sense.
It's you know, also, like, I mean, this is a problem which, you know, people talk about a lot with the Star Trek movies, especially, like, the next-gen movies, where it was all Data and Picard, and the other five people were basically just, you know, filling chairs or whatever.
Right.
And here is a case where you have like a million characters and they're all given their moment. Like even people like Bill Bellamy, you know, who's, you know, barely right. in it, but he still gets his moment and everything. Yeah. And it's really fleshed out this whole world. And like, there aren't any like characters there who are just like filling positions, you know, they all have their purpose and, you know, way more characters than Star Trek. And it's kind of disappointing that he wasn't able to bring that to Nemesis. Then again, maybe he would have been able to if he, you know, if we saw his full script on screen. But, you know.
You know, that's a maybe never. You know, like, I mean, the one thing I will say is it would have been so, you know, it's so fun to play what if sometimes, but how much fun would it be to have Oliver Stone do a Star Trek movie?
It would be really, really cool. And, you know, kind of like tying into that in a sense, like he had been trying to make this movie for years and years and years, and it was really, really hard for him to get the money together and for it to all come together. And in that time, he had gone off and done tons of other movies because he couldn't just sit around waiting for any given Sunday to get money. Right. And, you know, around, I'm going to say 97-ish, something in that area, after the success of Mission Impossible, Paramount decided to do Mission Impossible 2, and they hired Oliver Stone to direct. And he backed out eventually because the money finally came together for Any Given Sunday, and he couldn't do both. So he left wow. Mission Impossible 2 to do his dream project, which was Any wow. Given Sunday. But for a while there, it could have been Oliver Stone, and, you know, who knows the exact timeline and everything. But in those early stages, that script was being written by Ron Moore and Brandon Braga. How yeah. crazy would that have been, you know?
how wow. That would have been that's another, you know, one where you're going to be left to wonder. Oh, mm-hmm. my goodness. But, well, I mean, also, like, Mission Impossible, like, it makes sense for them to have tapped him because you're talking about something where it's like all betrayal and conspiracy and
oh, yeah.
all of these things going on. I mean, he's a perfect fit for that. I mean, yeah. I don't think that Mission Impossible as it has, I mean, it seems to have developed in a different way mm-hmm. Since then, you know, where it's just, you know, super team against the world sort of stuff. But yeah, I could have definitely seen Stone doing something like that in the early
oh, yeah.
phase.
That would have been awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much to talk about this movie and yes. so little time, but I think we're both in agreement that you should definitely check it out. You know, well worth the time. And
yes, ignore the Metacritic rating that you see; they are wrong.
I don't even know what it is, but I'm going to say that, you know, whenever there's a movie that has like a 95% rating or something like that, it's like, yeah, this movie is probably very good. But it's also probably very safe, you know, when you get to like the 50s or whatever, or the 30s or something, that's when you start getting the crazy awesome movies, you know?
And let's also put it this way. When was the last time both Mike and myself were this effusive about a film? Both of us at the same time, this crazy enthusiastic about something.
If you have a chance, I mean, okay, you can get it on, you know, iTunes or whatever. Where did you get your director's cut?
Amazon.
Okay.
It was $3 to rent it in okay. standard definition.
Okay. Get the high definition version.
Oliver Stone. You know, high def. It's worth the extra dollar.
Spend the extra dollar. Get it in high definition. If you have a nice sound system, crank it up. If you don't have a nice sound system and you're watching it by yourself, put on your headphones and crank those up to 11 and just be 100% blown away by this movie because it is awesome. And if you're from, you know, someplace that's not America and you could not care less about football, that's okay. If you've ever wondered what it's like to play football,
oh yeah,
watch this movie and you'll feel it. You'll feel yeah. it. So
yes, you will.
Yes, definitely check it out. I don't know. I still think, I mean, John Logan, since this movie has come out, like we've said, he's gotten 2 more Oscar nominations and all that stuff. He's made lots of good movies like Hugo and The Aviator and all this other stuff, Skyfall, Spectre. This, to me, still is the best thing he's ever done.
There's one other movie that I'll put in contention with it.
Okay, maybe we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been fun talking about Any Given Sunday this week, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And Jim Carrey, as they're fighting, he's like singing along. He's like, brah, brah. As he's fighting, he's singing along as he's fighting Matthew Broderick. And man, it's just so good. Like, to me, that's like, when I think of Star Trek and pop culture, like, that is the one, that's the first scene that I think of in the Cable Guy there.
Warp 5.
They never really do say what sport it is, right? We just assume it's baseball because he said doubleheader.
Well, he went to a baseball game with Herd, and he said baseball.
I think
game
he said Nick. Baseball in Doylestown earlier. So.
Yeah.
Oh, well. All right. Well, sorry, writers. You messed that one up then.
This is I don't even want to do this commentary anymore. Let's switch it to something else.
My whole life is a lie.
The 602 Club.
That's one thing I was very surprised about this book, is that when he does whatever mission it is that he's on, which maybe destroying a mind or something, or destroying even a ship, that he is doing everything he can to make sure no one is losing a life during this. That he's trying to do it in a way that people are not going to die, or at least a mass amount of people aren't going to die. And you would think, when you think of the Empire, it's like they don't care.
The Ready Room.
This is Lieutenant Stamets, a science officer specializing in astromycology, which is the study of fungi in space.
Fungi in space!
Yes, exactly. And I'm picturing the ship looks like a giant fungus.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Chris Steftenagel and Jeff Sutter. Thank you very much for helping us out, guys. If you want to be like Chris and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you, including early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and we'll come right up. So, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, well, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matt Rushing, a Star Wars show. And you can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, and venturing back over to the Nerd Party, co-hosting a show about Star Wars creators called Great Shot Kid with a delightful fellow named Mike.
Yeah, you can find me on that show. You can also find me on TalkFilmSociety.com doing Soderbergh 2828, where we talk about the work of Steven Soderbergh. And you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Track Stars, where we talk about whatever we want to talk about. and you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that's it for this week, but our little what's hopefully going to be a John Logan trilogy will continue next week with a look at his first James Bond movie, Skyfall.